Okay, I should be like Tina Turner and put more lipstick on and then try to cake the mic, right? Is that the, that's the way you use a mic, right? So this, welcome, this meeting was started by Colin Eisler, who's one of the presenters here, because he was kept suggesting for years, we need one on impedance. And so I sort of picked that ball up this year and ran with it. One announcement, unfortunately, Dennis Nosen is sick today. So if you're an acoustician that showed up today, here's our outline, and Dennis is going to have a rain check. So we wouldn't be offended if you came just for the acoustics part and you had to leave early because maybe you're not interested in impedance in audio interfaces. So, yeah. So that's unfortunate. He apologizes. He had an allergy/migraine, you know, bad scene. So we wish him well. And I made him promise that we'd have a rain check, and maybe in the fall we'll have a little more extended acoustics topic. So if anyone in that space wants to suggest to any committee member, people with little badges on, I should have one on myself. But what kind of topics you would want to cover in the fall that would be more acoustics oriented. So we're going to miss out on this acoustics impedance kind of discussion because Dennis isn't here, sadly. And then I'll do a little introduction. Colin's going to talk about audio interfaces and impedances. Since there's a little bit more time, maybe we'll have Dana's talk about loudspeaker impedance before the break. We'll take a little break. Next door, actually in Mike's house, there's, you know, water and cookies and cake and things, so we'll have that at the break time. You can't bring the water and food back in here, so everything has to be eaten over there. So grab your shoes and walk around if it's, you know, between the buildings, one of these shoeless places, which is fine. And then Mark Rogers, consultant up front here, is going to talk about distributed loudspeakers, constant voltage 70 volt world for impedances there, because that's another topic. So that's what we got covered, and I think I'm not missing anything, so let's just start. Okay. So resistance is futile was the sort of subtitle on here, and so most people have their head around a resistance. It's if you have an electronics degree of any kind, you go buy yourself a resistor, and here's a picture of what they look like. If you haven't seen these, might be hard to see from this from the back. We won't be offended if you stand up every once in a while to look at things. And the ohm is not, you know, something very familiar. And Colin's going to cover this again a little bit. I'm just trying to give you a little bit of background so we can have a context of discussions, or change the context of discussion as we go. Most of us know what a flashlight does. And so a flashlight has a battery and a couple of wires and a little resistor that you hook up to it. And then you adjust the resistor to adjust the brightness of your flashlight light. Or you remove the resistor altogether and blow up the light. Take your pick to go to town. I like the water analogy if you're new to electronics. Is this fun to put right in front of me? It is nice. If you use a water analogy and you use a water pump and you pump some water through some pipes and you put it in a little tank up here, a little reservoir, and then that comes out of a waterfall, you can put yourself a little turbine here and do some work. Like Snoqualmie Falls up here generates the power for most of our area. That's a basic schematic of extremely accurate schematic, the turbine size and all that. And so that's how you can get work out of water, and same exact analogy for electronics. And then you have what Henry Ott would call a charge reservoir. In fact, John Ott is related to Henry Ott in the back. Hi, John. Good to see you. So that's a basic, you know, way to think about basic electronics for resistors. The word that's going to come up a few more times here today is, resistance. A few more ideas on resistance, and then we'll get to reactance. The resistance of the pipe, as you try to get this water through here, you change the pipe diameter, it's changing the resistance. Nothing new, right? It's pretty easy for people to have their head around that. If you have a water tower, how many people grew up in a hometown with a water tower? Big, tall, and how many people climbed up the water tower? Anybody? Yeah? I mean, that's how you do it. And if you poke a hole in the water tower, you get some pretty good pressure out of that. And so that's nice because it's high off the ground. So higher pressure gives you more work, more higher voltage, higher potential. And if your water tank is next to the ground, like your rain downspout, if you have a rain downspout and you have yourself a rain barrel at home, that's how you can water your garden. Same idea. So that's resistance. Pretty basic. Reactance, however, is a little different. There's two sides of this. There's the left side capacitance and the right side inductance. And if you make yourself a capacitor, it's literally some metal, literally aluminum foil. You can make this at home with wax paper. How many people have made wax paper and aluminum foil? So nothing new here. This is just straight old fourth grade electronics. So you can make yourself some capacitors by just rolling up the wax paper and metal, put some conductors on there. And continuing this water analogy, there's two ways to think about how that would work. Capacitor would store, it stores charge, just like if you put a rubber diaphragm, something like if anyone do any turkey basting? You know, you suck the water up and then push it back out. That's a good way to think of what a capacitor does in an electronic circuit. It sucks up some water and pushes it back out again. So you have a little diaphragm in the center of this, and this squeezes it. One way to think of it. Another way to think of capacitor, and we'll see this picture again, is just it's storing a bunch of water, just a big glass with a tube at the bottom, and you're hooking it up to the pipe. And so if you got a larger diameter glass, it might have a certain amount of volts, the height or the potential energy of it. And then farad is the term for how many units of charge you got in there, coulombs. And you can have a wider diameter, and that would have just more charge, but maybe the same voltage. Just real basic way to think of a capacitor. And then inductance, I'm going to go around the back here. Inductance, same thing. Here's inductors. It's literally a coil of wire. You don't even need anything on the inside, just coil up wire. How many people made radio antennas when they were a kid? Or you take this is my favorite experiment, you take a little regular light bulb and wire on either side, and you spin the wire, make a big coil out of the wire, and then you just wave it in the air. Make sure you're in a magnetic field with lights on and stuff, and you can turn the light on, which is a favorite, you know, electricity 101 experiment I love. So that's what an inductor will do for you. Often they put a ferrite bead in there to make this work a little better. But continuing the analogy with water, it's kind of like a flywheel or a water wheel. And with a water wheel, you can change how much mass you would attach to the center axle of this, and you put a big old, you know, metal disc on this thing, and it's really heavy, and that would give it'll take a little more water to get this thing to roll and get going. And once it gets going, it's going to store that a little bit, and it's going to get discharge it as it goes. So that's another way to think about analogies for resistance, previous slides, capacitance and inductance. And now that we know those terms and have a basic picture of it, we can get to impedance. So I went and grabbed several dictionary definitions of impedance. One was from Bob Smith, our own Bob Smith, physio control back there. So he had a real simple one. Impedance, the complex combination of DC resistance and frequency-dependent reactance in an AC circuit. So backing up to the resistance, this is a DC. The water is only really sort of flowing in one way. And we'll see here in an animation I'll have in a moment that the water wheel or the diaphragm, the speed at which you fill these up and you know, fill it up and let it drain, or in the case of the water wheel, the speed at which you let this thing spin, that's a very frequency-dependent thing. And so that's where this impedance comes in. It's the combination of that resistance and the capacitance and the inductance combined. So all three of those things make up impedance. And that's what we're going to try to tackle today. So reactance, the capacitance, and the inductance are the non-resistant component of impedances in an AC circuit arising from the effect of inductance or capacitance or both causing the current to be out of phase, the timed lag as you try to get this water wheel going, for example, or fill up your tank and let it unfill is sort of how these things are going. So I'm not going to read every last one of these, but just trying to give you the flavor of the way people define this. And by the way, these slides, all the slides will be up on the website here in the next handful of days. We always gather up all the slides, so if you need to take these and read them later, if you find anything useful, that's great. Here's the Merriam-Webster definition. Something that impedes or hinders, it's a hindrance, such as, three examples, A, the apparent opposition in electrical circuit in an electrical circuit to the flow of the alternating current that is analogous to the actual electrical resistance to a direct current, and that is the ratio of effective electromotive force to that effective current. A little better. Electromotive force, and so that's this concept of how much potential energy is, you know, being pushed out, but it's frequency dependent in this case, alternating current. B here is the acoustic side of this world, the ratio of the pressure to the volume displacement at a given surface in a sound transmitting medium like air. And so this is not a solid wall, so I won't bash on it too hard, but this is a very different thing than a brick wall, right? So there's this idea in the acoustics world. If you're anybody in medicine here, here's another definition Merriam-Webster says, the opposition to blood flow in the circulatory system. Pretty exciting. The Encyclopedia Britannica has two definitions I grabbed. The electrical impedance is the measure of the total opposition that a current or a part of the circuit presents to the electrical current. So all this opposition of impedance. Impedance includes both resistance and reactance, like we've already said. And at the bottom, acoustic impedance, is the absorption of sound in a medium equal to the ratio of the sound pressure at a boundary surface to the sound flux, which is the flow velocity of the particles, or the volume velocity, times the area that that sound wave is against, basically. So there you go. Getting further, you can say these get a little longer. This is one of my favorites because this is from Dennis Bond. Dennis Bond, who retired last year from RAIN. This is the Pro Audio Reference, which is now actually Dennis donated the Pro Audio Reference Dictionary to the AES. So this is now up on the AES website, aes.org/PAR, Pro Audio Reference. And since I worked for Dennis for almost 30 years, we're a great guy. So his gets a little deeper. I like this one, especially because it uses the word banana. An important part of any discussion of impedance. Impedance, a measure of the complex resistance and reactive attributes of a component in an alternating current circuit. Impedance is what restricts current flow in an AC electric circuit. Impedance is not relevant to DC circuits. In DC circuits, resistors limit current flow because of their resistance. In AC circuits, inductors and capacitors similarly limit the AC current flow, but this is now because of their inductive or capacitive reactance. So reactance can be inductive or capacitive or both, as we'll see. Impedance is like resistance, but it is more. Impedance is the sum of a circuit or device's resistance and reactance. The reactance is measured in ohms, just like a resistance, but it is frequency dependent. Think of impedance as the complete or total current limit limiting, total current limiting ohms of a circuit. It's the whole banana. Always a great word to use in a dictionary of definition. Since AC circuits involve phase shift, i.e. the voltage and current are rarely in phase due to the storage mechanisms of these wheels and, you know, membranes we were talking about earlier. So think time. It takes time to charge and discharge these things, so on a capacitor and inductors. So the reactance is termed complex. And we promise not to have too many J omegas. Do you have any J omegas in your presentation?
I left out the imaginary stuff.
No imaginary stuff. This is what a mathematician, if you're in electronic school, you'd J omega is what you'd use to describe these things. So we're going to keep away from that. So that's the complex part, the stuff that's frequency dependent. And there's also the real part, which is really the resistive part, the resistance part. So that's what we're going to talk about. And it goes on, but really it's a nice way to do it. Nice definition. The PAR is a really amazing document, having worked with it for many years. Used to be Jeff's baby, actually. Yeah. All right. The Audio Dictionary, our own Gary. Where's Gary? He's hiding in the back. Editors of the Pro Audio, of this Audio Dictionary, third edition. And this gets even longer, and it gets into lots more background, and I'm just going to skip this altogether. Just to save time. It's actually a two-pager. It gets into the Ohm's law thing and condenser microphone impedance. So I would recommend, you know, check this out after we're done. I can show this to you. We'll load this up on the website. So there's a two-pager there that gets into all kinds of things. It even gets into a topic we're going to cover here in a little bit, which is the reflection, whether you have to match impedances or not in circuits. So we'll get to that. So that just as a time saver. So next, here's our AC circuit. Oh, I thought this was supposed to loop. You can imagine it looping. Yeah, everyone imagine looping. Okay, there we go. So we're back to this water analogy, and this is supposed to loop, but is not doing a nice job of it. So you can see the particles moving back and forth. So this is an alternating current kind of circuit, not a DC kind of circuit. So imagine that looping. So this piston in the center here, is rotating around and pushing the water back and forth. That's what AC circuits are doing, and the sort of the continuing that plumbing analogy we started with earlier. And then I found some nice pictures. I didn't draw all these originally. Google is your friend when it comes to graphics. I'm not really a good artist, so there you go. So here's a little circuit if you're an electronics guy, where you have the resistors and you have a capacitor and an inductor and even a diode here. We haven't even covered diodes. And then you got AC circuitry. So if this pump is going up and down, and you turn the switch on, and you're happy, you got a little resistor here. Might be hard to see from the back. Anybody got binoculars? Good. Here's your capacitor, a little storing the water in here. So that's the water coming up and down and flow up and down a little bit, which is a really nice way to visualize what's going on here. Here's your diode that turns on and off, so the water's allowed to go this way, but not the other way. Kind of a clean way to do that. And here's your sort of flywheel inductor that's doing its job. So you can sort of picture how this works. It's a nice visual way to think if you're not used to the complexity of things that are changing in time and how the plumbing would act. So it's a good mental way if you're used to this or you're trying to get your head around electronics on how that works. So that was the basics of some plumbing analogies and resistance, capacitance, etc. We're going to come back to this topic, and Colin has some of this more. I just wanted to introduce it. How many people remember when telephone lines were analog? Anybody old enough? Anyone with gray hair probably would remember that. So remember, the length of this cable is how long? Stupid long. Many, many miles, all the way across the country kind of thing. And these were unbalanced, by the way. Unbalanced. How many people run unbalanced cables this long in their... anything? Yeah. So you need, you know, serious transformers and all kinds of things. So the cable length versus the signal that you send in it, the highest frequency, the wavelength of the signal is going to be a factor in old telephone systems back in the day. And you suppose hooking things up like this would change anything about the electrical characteristics? This is a picture of all kinds of little, somebody clamping a bunch of test leads, essentially, between a bunch of telephone cables. I know it's hard to see this from the back. And then how many people at home run cables between their, remember VCRs? So I found some old pictures too. TVs, hi-fi, it's all a very short distance. And so the importance of the wavelength of the signal versus the cable length is not important in a very small space. So it's just, before we come back to this, I just want to plant the seed of the length of things. And these days, do you think the signals heading down cables like HDMI are fast now, faster data rate? They're stupid fast data rates. And so now, does the cable impedance maybe matter more? And we're going to revisit this more as we go. So there's that. A couple more slides and we're done. So this wavelength concept is going to come back. So if you're an audio person, nice how I throw the auto mixer off. You can do this. Anybody into auto mixers? I'm just being smartass. All right. So, of course, you have an audio signal here, and you have the length between the like points on the curve here. I know this is some basic stuff, but the distance of these things. So here's a picture, probably can't see from the back, of the entire electromagnetic spectrum from 1 hertz down here, power, and audio is just this little tiny piece down here, 100 kilohertz. And then the blue section here is up here in the AM radio band, 10 megahertz. The yellow stuff in here is FM, 100 megahertz. And up here we got gigahertz. That's cell phones, 2.4 something gigahertz. So this is the whole electromagnetic spectrum, and under here you can't quite see it from here. But here's the distance for these wavelengths for each of these different electromagnetic spectrum points. So 10,000 feet for this 100 thing, 1,000, 100, 10 feet, 1 foot out here. It's 1 foot for your cell phone. So just thinking out loud, just thinking about the length of these waves is what we're going to get back to when we get to Colin's interface and whether the cable length and impedance matching is going to be important or not. And then acoustically, here's the same thing for acoustic waves, stuff in air. So if you had yourself a cylinder with a piston here pushing the air molecules back and forth together, and this thing's moving back and forth, and the mathematicians would argue, like JJ would, that this piston has to be infinitely long, right, JJ?
Well, no, it just has to have a perfect match at the far end to a resistor.
There you go. Exactly. So we did the same kind of thing here. We just said, okay, let's take the audio spectrum, the low frequency, the mid frequencies, and the high frequencies, and divide that into pieces and come up with what the wavelengths are here. And so it's just the same thing. But now we're in acoustic world, so we're looking at 16 kilohertz, 12 miles. So now when you go 50 miles or 400 miles with your telephone cable length, 12 miles to get 16 kilohertz down that thing, how many people can hear 16 kilohertz in their telephones? Not going
to
happen.
Well, there's more to your wire line if you still have a copper line. It's also C is well under 0.5 there.
Yeah.
So, you have to have those the wavelengths, and then you have this whopping all-pass filter.
Exactly. JJ has, how many patents on codecs, telephones from the... Don't even go there?
Too many.
We're not going there. I'm not going there. So the graphic at the bottom is trying to talk about, if you're talking about this piston and sending air down this tube, cylinder, if you're trying to figure out the size of this tube, and let's say we pick the simple one, the 1 kilohertz band, and therefore that's about a foot in wavelength. So you can have an effective directivity of this sound exiting the end of this thing and being happy if the size of the cylinder is a foot. And then if you go down an octave, the effectiveness at 1 kilohertz of this guy down here at the low frequency is not as good. It's going to fall off there. And at the same at the higher end, the effectiveness of that at the higher end up at 1.5 inches at 8 kilohertz or so, the effectiveness of this cylinder being happy. So just trying to give you this mental picture. Not great at controlling 1 kilohertz is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
Yep. So you can slide all three of these arrows slide together if you wanted to come up with what the size cylinder you would need to pull off this directivity kind of thing. So, but Dennis is not here to get into the more details of this. This was an intro for Dennis, but he's not here. We'll have to repeat this again next week. So that's my just a basic intro to some of these ideas that I think are going to be hashed around as we continue down with other presenters. Any questions? And go from there. So Colin is up next.
Okay, I've got a little bit of a review of what Steve was talking about, but a little bit more from an electrical standpoint, not as many analogies, but more from what does this mean for electrical interfaces between devices. Oh, I'm jumping ahead here. So, first of all, a couple more pictures of resistors. A resistance, by definition, is the ratio of current and voltage in an electrical circuit. The units are ohms. And then a couple of examples of... It's getting away from me. A couple of examples of things that are a resistor or exhibit a resistance. A resistor, the circuit item itself, a wire. A wire has a resistance to it. And then traces in a circuit board. They're not a zero resistance. Those will have some inherent resistance to them.
Sorry, I've had to remind people of this occasionally.
Yeah, it's easy to forget when you're first getting started with this that, wow, this is really running.
That's why I use the
wall. Yeah, so let's go back. Here we go. I'm going to leave that alone. So we've got a resistance, which takes many forms, not just an actual resistor in a circuit. Next up, one form of reactance is capacitive reactance, which often takes the form of a physical capacitor. There's a variety of different sizes of capacitors, the circuit symbol right there. And then some more examples of other items that may be capacitors or exhibit a capacitance. Two wires near each other, two electrical conductors near each other can behave as a capacitor. PCB traces near each other can exhibit a capacitance. So also the units here of capacitors are in farads. One farad is massive. You might see those in the subwoofer circuit in your car amplifier if you need a really big source of juice. But most of the time we're talking about billionths or trillionths of a farad, so pico or nano or micro farads. In fact, a micro farad is a reasonable size capacitor in a circuit. The other kind of reactance that we have is an inductive reactance. It looks like Steve and I have the same clip art guy. So there's an example of a coil of wire. Like Steve said, they also are often coiled around a ferrite or a magnetic material because the magnetic properties of the material near that wire help determine its inductance. So if you use a magnetic material that has... different properties compared with air, you can create a different inductor. One example of that is the lumps you'll see on a USB cable or some unbalanced audio cables. Those are ferrites that are clamped onto the cable to change the inductance of that cable at very high frequencies. They're often kind of an admission of failure from an electrical design standpoint, because if you really designed your interfaces properly, you wouldn't have needed that on the cable. You would have handled it internally. So some other examples of inductors, a wire is also an inductor. So you'll see the, you know, the going theme here that a wire can behave as a resistor and an inductor. And if you add another wire, then you've got a capacitor. And that starts to play in very heavily here. PCB traces, again, can behave as an inductor. And a transformer is a special type of coupled inductor. The other key point, let me jump back one here, is that a capacitor resists instantaneous changes in voltage. Now, that's because a capacitor is the ratio of current and change in voltage over time. So that's important to remember as we start talking about higher and higher frequencies. As we are changing voltage faster, then there are different impedance behaviors of a capacitance. Likwise, go ahead, Steve.
If you're trying to fill a glass up with water and back and forth fast, it's pretty hard to do.
Exactly. Likewise with an inductor is the ratio of voltage and the change in current over time. So a inductor sort of resists instantaneous changes in current. So you can't change a current very quickly through an inductive reactance. So now that we have some basics, let's talk about what's the point here. What's the point of an audio interface? We're transferring information from one device to another, from one thing to another. So there are a few things we need to decide or know about that interface and that information is, what form does it take? If we're talking about analog audio, the information that we're exchanging is frequency information, the rate of change, phase information, the time alignment, and amplitude, the level of signal. If we're talking about digital audio, really all that we care about in the interface is the data rate. There's encoded information in there, but the interface isn't decoding that. That's something on the receiving device that's going to decode that information. So what's most important to us is the data rate of that interface. And what's key to remember is the higher the frequency, you know, the more we're trying to change our signal, the more the cable and wire impedance becomes a factor. The other thing we need to know is how far. How far do we want to send this information? Because again, the longer the distance, the more that cable or wire impedance is going to matter. The other thing that's important is, what do we want to do with that information once we get it there? Do we just want to measure it? You know, that's the case with a microphone input or a line level input. We just want to know what that is so we can do something with it. This is voltage transfer, is what we'll talk about next. This also allows us to minimize some losses. If we're just going to measure something, we don't have to push the interface very hard. The other option is if we want to do some work with it. If we want to drive a loudspeaker, just warm up the rack room a little bit, you know, this is transferring power. Like Steve's analogy, we're returning a flywheel or something like that. We are moving something. We're physically doing some work with that energy. And that's certainly something that is most commonly done with a loudspeaker, where we have to push that air. And that's the work that we're doing with that information. Common with the old telephone systems, too, where the actual microphone in the sending phone, the power from that input is actually driving or was actually driving the speaker on the other end of that old telephone line. The other thing just to think about is, if we just want to go, we just want to get to the other end, we want to go a long distance, that's another sort of special case. And we've mentioned transmission lines and old telephone lines, but we'll talk about that as a separate case from voltage transfer and power transfer. But let's start here with voltage transfer. This is the most common sort of analog audio interface that we'll have between pro or consumer audio devices. And we have an example circuit right here with an output resistance and a load resistance and our voltage source here. And we've got some wire capacitance too. In this particular example, we're at a low enough frequency where the wire inductance isn't a factor. So I'm going to put that aside for now. And first, let's just talk about the voltage across our whole system. We have Vin, and then we've got two resistors, so we've got a voltage across this whole system. And what we want to do is maximize that voltage in the load resistor. So if we've got a voltage across our output impedance, which is purely resistive in this example, and our load impedance, which is, for right now, we'll just look at the resistive aspect of that. We want to maximize the voltage across that. So we have a current rolling through, or a current through those two impedances. And if one typical rule of thumb is if we have a load or an input impedance that's 10 times what our output impedance is, we'll generally have pretty good voltage transfer. You know, if this is forming a voltage resistor or voltage divider, excuse me, and if we have our load resistance is 10 times our output resistance, then we have our voltage in is our output voltage, excuse me, is our load over the combination of the two resistances. So that gives us 90% voltage transfer. That's pretty good. We don't have a whole lot of losses there. That's not going to be very noticeable. I actually didn't convert this into dB. Anybody know how what that is in dB? No, I think about one. It's about 1 dB. So it's really not a noticeable difference to the human ear most of the time. So we left the cable capacitance out of that first example, but there are many cases where that's just, it's not acceptable. And we can see in this same example, the capacitance of the wire at hand, Belden 8451, balanced cable is 34 picofarads per foot. So if you're running that 500 feet, you have 0.17 microfarads total capacitance. So if we think of that as a low-pass filter that's formed between our output resistance and our wire capacitance, we can figure out what the cutoff frequency is of that filter. You know, at what point does that filter start becoming a factor in our interface? At one point will it start rolling off the high frequencies? So if we have, for example, a 200 ohm output impedance was on the high side, but not uncommon. And we have 0.017 microfarads. The cutoff frequency for that is 1 over 2 pi times R times C. And that gives us a 3 dB down point of 46.8 kilohertz, which is well above the typical audible range. So for this example, yes, Steve.
My dog can hear that, though.
Do you have super tweeters in your home that can reproduce that? So for this example, 500 feet with that kind of cable run is no problem. It's going to be well above any noticeable reduction in signal. Not to mention the fact that for most music, multi-tone audio signal, you tend to have a 6 dB per octave roll-off of the higher frequencies anyway, just because of the energy that those contribute to a music signal. So you are able to get away with even more, even lower of a cutoff frequency than this particular example without a noticeable decrease in fidelity. And this particular circuit example is from a Rain Note called Practical Line Driving Amplifiers, I believe. And that can be found on the Rain website still. All the Rain educational information aside from the Pro Audio reference is still up there. And this gives a great table of different types of cable and different length of runs, just to give you some ballparks of driving a line.
Excuse me, I was going to say,
go ahead.
From a marketing perspective, though, you can buy these special low capacitance cables.
Right.
10 picofarad, but cost about three times as much. But
yeah, and you.
That, so you can stretch it out to, I guess in this case, it would be 120 kilohertz.
Yeah, and that will sound even better.
Yeah.
No, so you can get away with surprisingly, from a marketing standpoint, surprisingly bad specs of cable if you do the math. And that can end up saving you or your clients a lot of money. Or you can charge your clients for the expensive stuff and use the...
It's always good to know how big your client's checkbook is, too.
Yeah. So we've looked at input and output impedance from a standard line interface perspective, and a little bit at the wire capacitance, the reactance of the wire from a capacitive perspective. Another thing that comes to play with line interfaces is balanced. Now, balanced interfaces, balanced signal, has a bit of a misnomer in that it has nothing to do with the signal that you're actually carrying on that interface. So most of the time you have a positive signal on the plus side and you've got the inverse of that on the minus side, but that's not what defines a balanced interface. So the definition, as it says here, is a balanced interconnect system. Both of the signal conductors have an equal and non-zero impedance to ground. So your regular RCA wire has two conductors, but one of them is ground, so the impedance to ground there is zero. And in this case, this example shows the R out for each of those, and then the input impedance to ground. If that is the same, then this is considered, or very close, this is considered a balanced interface. And the advantage to that is if you have a signal that's induced into that wire, if you have some sort of noise that induces a current, that will develop a noise voltage, Vn, there across that leg. And if these are very tightly coupled, if it's a twisted pair cable, you should have the same induced noise signal on both conductors. And what that'll give you is the exact same induced noise voltage across the input impedance. And when that occurs, if you have a properly designed differential input, anything that's common to both sides of that signal will be canceled out. So that's where the impedance, the input impedance of that balanced interface is key, because the noise is induced as a current. It's magnetically induced. And so if the impedance is matched, the voltage that you get on the input impedance from that current will be identical. And then it will be canceled out. That's known as the common mode signal.
But the
go ahead.
The construction of the cable is very important to that relationship.
Yes, okay. Because you have to make sure that whatever's induced on one wire is also induced equally on the other.
Equal size and everything.
Yeah, equal. You really want the same conductor.
Yeah, the twisting is the most important.
The twisting part. And the most important part there, yeah. So that they're equally exposed.
It's also important to note that the source impedances are also equal. That's also part of the equation.
Yeah. This impedance and that impedance, these match and these match.
Yeah. Okay.
They both have to.
Yeah. They both have to match.
There was a story a long time ago on the balanced pair where the red diameter of the insulator was different from the black diameter of the insulator. And then there was a mismatch of the common mode.
Yeah. That'll do it.
Everything. That wire's cheaper.
Yeah.
Probably handsome.
Hey, Colin, does the twist rate affect absorb different frequencies better than one twist rate differently than another one?
I believe the twist rate does impact the capacitance of the cable. But so you're asking, does that affect how a signal might be induced onto that wire?
Yeah, and the cancellation properties thereof, or the equalness of the...
I believe so. That would be right.
I think it would depend on the interfering signal, too.
Yeah.
The higher the interfering signal, the tighter you'd want.
Think of it as everywhere you're twisting, you're forming a loop.
Yep. So the tighter the twist, the smaller the loop area of the overall signal. So, yeah, that would have
a... Cables with varying twist rates on adjacent pairs, that's to reduce cross... contamination between the pairs.
So Mark's saying that cables with multiple twisted pairs with varying twist rates, that's meant to avoid interference between the pairs. Is that right? Yeah. Steve?
So as an example, Cat 5 Ethernet cable is that an example of this cable that each of the four twists in a Cat 5 cable with the four twists, each of those has a different twist rate to avoid this problem that they all pick up the exact same signal all the time, and there are four differential inputs, four of these, at each end of an Ethernet cable, and its goal in life is to not have the same exact interference pick up on each of these things so they can all work together in harmony. Those Ethernet interfaces get extremely fancy, and HDMI even gets further, where they do a time TDMS. What's that stand for?
I don't remember.
Yeah. They do every time you plug HDMI in, for example, it checks what each of the twists can actually do as far as the highest band rate, and it filters it depending on the cable today and what interference is hitting the cable today. And if you move the cable, it'll do this on the fly, which is mind-boggling. Think about that for a little while. You move the cable around, and it's going to change the characteristics, and it can and will adjust the data rate that the cable can even handle, which is pretty heavy for us audio analog guys, right?
It also changes with temperature and humidity.
Yeah, amazing stuff.
Yeah. So that's an example of a balanced impedance. Many examples. So the other way we might want to use this information that we're sending over this interface is to do some work. We want to transfer power. Power electrically is the product of voltage and current. Historically, was notated with an E. Nowadays it's V times I. The unit is watts, joules per second. So this is the amount of work being done per second. And a little bit of review. When is the power necessary if we're going to move something? If we're going to physically move some air with a loudspeaker or turn a crank or turn a motor. In our case, most of the time it's moving a loudspeaker. In this case, we've got, again, an output impedance and a load impedance. And the current through that, through this interface here, is, if we have a fixed voltage, the current through that interface is really going to be determined by those impedances. So if we have a total voltage across here, then the total current is the total is the total voltage divided by the total impedance. And so in that case, the power is that current times that voltage total, or if we combine those two equations, the total power is the voltage we have squared times, or divided by the impedance. So for a fixed max voltage, say we have a maximum output voltage of a certain amount, the interface power is determined by that, the total interface power is determined by that input and output impedance. So what do we do when we want to maximize the impedance in the load? Because we're going to have losses in the output impedance here, because we've got a total amount of power, some of it's going to be dissipated in that output impedance. So the problem here is, as we this let me start by explaining this graph a little bit. This is showing the relationship between, this is normalized, that's why we have 1 up here. This is normalized to 1 volt, 1 ohm, 1 amp, just for comparisons. Now we have a little example circuit here where we've got an output impedance output resistance of 1, a voltage of 1, and a load resistance here. And what we're showing in this curve is, as we increase the voltage across the load by increasing that impedance, we're decreasing the current through that load, because we're increasing the overall impedance of that interface. And what we see is the middle point here, where we're maximizing power, is where we have our input and our source impedance matched. So this is a great example of what people mean when they're talking about matched impedance, is a power transfer. So earlier we were talking about voltage transfer. I've heard it referred to as matched impedance. Oh, if you've got 10 times your input impedance to your output impedance, that's matched. It's not matched. That's impedance bridging is the term for that. This is impedance matching, where you have the same output impedance as load impedance. You will maximize the power in that load. This tends to come up a lot in tube amplifier outputs, because tubes are a high impedance device, or compared to solid state outputs, they certainly are. So if you're trying to drive an 8-ohm loudspeaker with a 2K output impedance from a tube amplifier, you're really going to minimize the amount of power you put in that loudspeaker, which is why a matching transformer is used in that kind of amplifier. It translates the impedance of the loudspeaker to look, from the tube amp's perspective, to look like a higher impedance so you can maximize the power into that load.
So the 10-ohm rule, I've heard it's with a microphone with a preamp. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's where that makes
yes.
work. So the 10 times thing is for that.
Not yeah.
necessarily matching for speaker kind of stuff.
Right. In that case, you're transferring voltage from the microphone to your microphone preamp.
Yeah.
And like a line level input is another example of that. Go ahead, Steve.
This is where the definition that I skipped over, the long one, in the audio dictionary is worth reading for that exact idea. It gets across this idea that you have this voltage transfer you need with a microphone to an input stage, and with a line level output to another line level. But as soon as you're dealing with very low impedances here, these loudspeaker world, you have to have this power transfers, which you're sort of after.
Right.
And so that's sort of the delineation is, boy, we're talking power loudspeakers now, and the impedances are pretty low. So, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think this Dana is going to pound this nail further in a little while.
Yeah. So I will mention that I've used 8 ohms as an example for a loudspeaker. He's going to get much deeper into what that means in terms of the actual impedance, which is much more complex than just, it's kind of like an 8-ohm resistor. It's not. So the next piece of this is if we want to go a distance, right? We mentioned if we want to travel a very long distance with our signal, the idea of electrical transmission lines comes into play. Now, a transmission line is when the cable length exceeds one wavelength of the highest frequency. A transmission line behaviors need to be addressed. Now, what are transmission line behaviors? That is, you can see a few just basic images of how a transmission line is drawn. And that Z0 you see in the middle is what's referred to as the characteristic impedance. Now, it's a little different from the way we've been thinking about impedances before, because interesting things start to happen when the phase at the source is not the same as the phase at the other end of the line. Now, what I mean by that is if your length of cabling is so much longer than the wavelength of the signal that when you're done transmitting your wave, it hasn't even reached the other end yet, some very interesting electrical things start to happen. And so you no longer just have effectively a wire. You start to see all those reactances come into play. So you start to see very small distributed capacitances and distributed inductances along that whole wire. So you're charging up every little segment of the wire as you send your wave across. And what that means is you start to have wave propagation effects that you would picture in a pool or in a rope. And that starts to happen electrically. Now I have an example of wave propagation using skewers and gummy bears, just to give you an example of what happens along a physical transmission line, which is a great analog.
Hi, I'm Jared. Welcome to Fun Science Demos. Today, we want to take a look at two forms of energy.
We're going to skip a little bit, Jared.
So now we get to see this wave machine in action. A wave is energy, so I need to add some energy to this wave machine. And when I do that, I want you to watch that energy move down the machine from one end back to the other. Watch. Did you see the energy move down the machine?
So let's do that one more time. And you can see it's not just once down and then back. It continues to bounce. And this is all related to the, yes, it is. It's related to termination. So here's the second wave coming back, and now the second reflection.
And then back down the machine, and back toward me.
So this will, in a transmission line connection, this will continue to happen back and forth unless there's adequate termination to dissipate these reflections.
So if you grew up in the analog telephone days, that's what would happen. You'd get on the phone and you'd hear somebody's voice back. You'd hear this reflection. That's exactly what happens in an old analog telephone line. Mm-hmm. There's no such thing pretty much anymore, and that's kind of gone away. But still, every once in a blue moon, you get on the phone, you'll hear a bad echo. It might not be caused by this. There's another way this happens in the digital world. But that's what that is. That's where it came from. The telephone lines had to be matched impedances.
Exactly.
A long, you know, miles away. Exactly. Otherwise, you'd get this reflection back, and you'd literally hear things back to yourself.
Yeah.
Like calling Alaska.
Yeah.
That's
exactly.
Okay, so here's another visual representation of what's happening in the transmission line. In this particular case, we have a source impedance, we have a characteristic impedance of the line, which is determined by its geometry, and we have a load impedance. And when you first send a signal, that's going to go through the line and be hopefully dissipated in the load impedance. But if there's a reflection, the reason for matching the source impedance is when that reflection comes back, the transmission line just looks like it's reversed. And so now you have another long transmission line, and that source impedance now becomes your load. So any reflections that come back to the source, we want them dissipated in that source impedance. Any questions about this so far? Okay. So without proper termination, we'll have reflections back and forth. And if you're continuing to drive this line, any of those out-of-phase reflections will cause destructive interference. So they will screw up the transmission of your further signal because you're getting the reflection back, which is exactly what Steve was talking about. If you're just talking to somebody and you hear yourself coming back to yourself, it's a little disorienting. And that can happen in any electrical transmission environment that is physically longer than the wavelengths of the signals that we're talking about. So I think a little bit earlier, I skipped the comment earlier I had about source and load termination is recommended when the lines approach a quarter of the wavelength of the signal that you're sending. And a couple of examples here are 20 kilohertz has a wavelength, 20 kilohertz electrical signal has a wavelength of about 3.75 kilometers, a quarter wavelength, excuse me, and 6.144 megahertz, which happens to be the data rate, the bit rate of AES-EBU at 48 kilohertz sampling rate, that has a quarter wavelength of 12.2 meters. So that starts to go from citywide transmission sort of size systems to within one building.
So this is where you can go out and you can buy AES-3 cable that's designed to deal with this because it's trying to solve this in transmission line problem because you got AES-3 or what used to be called AES-EBU at 6 megahertz and you need more careful attention to the impedance and the capacitance of the cable if you're running that kind of digital signal further than the 12 meters, which you can certainly do. By the way, Cat5 cable is twisted very well and happens to transmit AES-3 signals really, really well for much cheaper than the specialty AES-3 cable does.
Yeah.
It's roughly the same impedance.
Yeah, it's about 100 ohm range, and AES is, the spec says 110.
Yeah.
So we've been talking about telephones, but I wanted to go over this example again because it ties into another impedance matching sort of tradition in the audio industry that doesn't really isn't as important as it used to be. But when telephone systems were first being installed, they just used the old telegraph wires, single wire, all the return was through the ground, the actual ground. And when they tried to transmit very far, they had incredible problems with attenuation because they were returning through the ground. So they started transmitting two wires, or they set up transmission systems with two wires. And as it turns out, if you look at the geometry of the old telephone lines, if they were using six gauge wire with a diameter of about 0.162 inches, sorry, I didn't put units on that, and they were spaced out by about 12 inches, then the with the electrical permeability of air, the relative permeability of air being about 1.0054, that gives us a characteristic impedance of about 600 ohms. And as the telephone guys were very used to having to match their impedances to the characteristic impedance of the line, they got accustomed to making everything a 600 ohm impedance. So when the radio guys were learning from the telephone systems, they were very used to, it must be a 600 ohm matched impedance. It must be, because that's what works with transmitting audio over long wires. And then they started using twisted pair in the radio stations. If you get a long enough piece of twisted pair, 24 gauge wire, you might measure 600 ohms, and then you can feel good about yourself, and then you can have a 600 ohm output, 600 ohm wire, and a 600 ohm input impedance, but it's not really the same thing. And that, thankfully, was studied, and a lot of people learned how to adjust the input impedances, so they got more of a voltage transfer interface. Questions about
that? What are the drawbacks about this matched impedance thing coming up there?
What are the drawbacks? Yeah. Attenuation.
Loss of power.
Loss of power. If you're matching your impedances, you're going to have a 6 dB loss in signal every time. And as we talked about earlier, with a voltage transfer where you have 10 times the input impedance to output impedance, you're only losing about a dB.
There's still holdovers from those glory days.
Yeah.
With the dBU, 1 milliwatt dissipated in 600 ohms.
Yes, exactly. In fact, one of the meetings where I brought up the idea of doing a discussion of impedance was when Mark discussed the dB and the history of the different references for dB. The other transmission line that I wanted to talk about as an example is the AES-3 or AES-EBU transmission line, and Steve brought this up a little earlier. This is the example circuit provided by TI for one of their transceivers, their receiver transmitters for digital audio, and they recommend that you have an output impedance here of 110 ohms and an input impedance loading that of 110 ohms, and that's specifically designed to match the 110 ohm AES balanced cable. So while you can get away with just plugging two AES-3 interfaces together with mic cable, I'm guilty of doing that, it will only get you so far. And if you make a habit of running long cable runs for AES-3 interfaces, it'll bite you.
Interesting.
Go ahead.
That was one of the reasons for picking a balanced input, balanced system for digital audio in the beginning. People said, you can just use your microphone cables to send it.
Oh, yeah. So he's saying that
cables can be anything from 30 ohms to 100 ohms, depending on whether you have.
Yeah, so he's saying one of the reasons why a balanced interface was chosen for AES-EBU was so, you could just use your microphone cable that you already had without yet thinking about the importance of that transmission impedance, that characteristic impedance.
Probably wasn't as big a deal when it was 300 baud.
Yeah, that's true, too.
This is digital audio.
So let's just review a little bit. We have voltage transfer, which is referred to as impedance bridging. Now, we're not transferring power, we're not doing work, we're just measuring the output. And this is very typical for pro and consumer analog audio interfaces. We want our input impedance to be about 10 times our output impedance for good voltage transfer. And if we keep the reactance low, then we don't have to think about the cable impact as much. But as you have longer and longer cable runs, reactance of the cable does become an issue. Then with power transfer, in order to maximize the power, we want to match the input and output impedances. to maximize the power transfer. You're still going to have losses because you have power dissipated in the source impedance, but you will maximize the delivery of power to that load. And this is often necessary when the output is not a low impedance output. And I think Mark will discuss a little bit later power amplifiers and how they relate to loudspeaker loads. And the other type of interface we have is transmission lines. This is also a situation where impedance matching is necessary, not for power transfer so much, but for minimizing reflections and avoiding that destructive interference. This maintains signal integrity. Okay. Any other questions about interface impedances or just thoughts, discussions, history?
So I just wanted to talk about over-twisting the wire. I don't think we can generally say that more twisting is better, because if you over-twist it, like if it's ever twisted every quarter inch, the other things happen. The capacitance goes up and other issues like that.
Okay. Any other questions? Margarita clock? Oh, no, not margaritas. any issues, Dan, you're going to bring up? We're going to have a break here. Remember that to fill out your forms if you haven't filled it out for the door prizes, and whether you want to continue to get our emails when new meetings are coming up. And we have some cookies and water next door and some cake. And so we'll come back in 15 minutes or so.
And that's where the bathroom is also, is in the other building.
Great.
And I wanted to say that the committee appreciates your indulgence for your complete inability to see the screen most of the time. Mm-hmm. I'm sure it works a lot better when there's not all these damn heads in the way. Yeah. But you should know that your committee is a bunch of cheap bastards, and we rely on 100% donations for all of our meeting space, and we appreciate being able to be here in all of our other places too. So thank you. So you'll call it when it's time to start.
Yeah, we'll start in 15 minutes, 10 after. Go from there. Thank you all. Thanks, Colin. We'll come back and we'll draw the prizes. You must be present to win the prizes, by the way.